politics. But if we want to continue this work, we certainly need a person in office who will be more amenable to our mass pressure. And to me, that is the only thing that someone like Joe Biden represents. But we have to persuade people to go out and vote to guarantee that the current occupant of the White House is forever ousted.
Angela Davis, I want to thank you so much for this hour. World-renowned abolitionist, author, activist, professor emerita at the University of California, Santa Cruz, author of many books, including Freedom is a Constant Struggle, Ferguson, Palestine, and the Foundations of Movement. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Stay safe.
Are tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned, values-driven natural foods cooperative open daily from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. during the pandemic, featuring farm-direct organic produce from more than 30 local farms, bulk foods, and farmers market every Wednesday year-round. Located at Southeast Tibbet Street and 21st Avenue in Portland for almost 50 years. Online at peoples.coop.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the city of Portland fails to pass next year's budget. Oregon Governor Kate Brown freezes the reopening process statewide for at least 1 week. And in national news, Louisville has banned no-knock warrants in the wake of the police shooting of Breonna Taylor. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 12, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. Yesterday, the Portland City Council failed to reach a unanimous vote on the new city budget. The new budget would cut planned police spending by $15 million and eliminate over 80 police positions. After voting with three other council members on a series of amendments that would redirect money from the Portland Police Bureau to community-based organizations, Commissioner Chloe Udaly voted against its adoption. Udaly explained her vote by saying the budget cuts fell short of the public demands to cut it by as much as $50 million. The vote came after public testimonies on Wednesday and Thursday from several hundred people in favor of widespread justice system reforms, including the complete abolition of the Portland Police Bureau. Commissioners Joanne Hardesty and Amanda Fritz both voted yes on the budget. In a statement on Twitter after the meeting, Hardesty said that while Udaly can, quote, take a principled no stance on passing this budget, I as a black woman cannot, unquote. Hardesty characterized Udaly's vote as, quote, performative allyship, and said her colleagues had not supported her 2019 budget proposals to make cuts to the Portland Police Bureau. In addition to Udaly, Mayor Ted Wheeler also voted no on the budget to buy the council more time to reach a decision. Due to an emergency clause, the council needed to reach a unanimous vote to pass the budget, but the council can vote again next Wednesday. At that time, it will only need to reach a majority vote to pass the city budget for the 2020-2021 fiscal year. To the disappointment of many, last night, Oregon Governor Kate Brown froze reopening in place statewide. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade and Ray Bodwell have this report.
Late yesterday, due to an alarming increase in COVID-19 infections throughout the state, Governor Brown put the brakes on Multnomah County's application to move to Phase 1 and froze all other counties in their current position. This morning, the governor held a press conference where she and state health officials outlined their concerns and acknowledged the frustration of residents and business owners statewide.
When we began reopening nearly a month ago, I was clear that COVID-19 cases, our counts would rise. Unfortunately, we are now seeing that happen in several parts of the state in both rural and urban Oregon. The noticeable increase in COVID-19 infections in Oregon over the past week is certainly cause for concern. In order to slow the transmission of the virus, I am putting all pending county reopening applications on hold for 7 days. This one-week pause will give our public health experts time to assess what factors are driving the spread of the virus and determine if we need to adjust our approach to reopening. I know how frustrating it is to move slowly. We all wish this reopening could be happening faster. My job, however, is to make tough decisions, even when they are unpopular. And when it comes to the health and safety of Oregonians, the buck stops here. To all of the business owners who had planned to reopen this weekend, I want to acknowledge how difficult this is for all of you. Many of you have invested significant time and resources into reopening safely, ordering supplies, hiring staff, and just keeping your lights on. However, as Dr. Fauci has said, we don't make the timeline, the virus makes the timeline.
Brown then turned the mic over to Pat Allen, the director of the Oregon Health Authority, who provided additional detail behind the decision.
Here are some of the warning signs we're watching. New cases are rising. Yesterday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 178 new cases of COVID-19, our highest total ever. The number of COVID tests reported, 18,271, increased compared to the previous week, which is good news, but the percent positive rose from 1.9 to 3%. Hospitalizations have increased. New hospitalizations were on a long downtrend, but the 7-day rolling average rose in the past week from 4 to 6 cases of severe COVID-19 illness per day. Because the number of severe coronavirus cases does not depend on the amount of testing we're doing, new hospitalizations are a telling measure of how well we're doing.
Allen pointed out that some of the spike in cases is linked to large workplace outbreaks and expressed concerns about the as yet unknown impact of large gatherings, including the protests that have been going on in Portland and around the state. He concluded by reminding people that reopening does not mean a return to normal.
Ultimately, my biggest fear is that people treat phase one or phase two like returning to things the way they were before the pandemic began. That's not what needs to happen. We can do normal things, but not the way we did them before. Keep physically separated. Wear a mask when you're close to other people. Don't go to work when you're sick. Wash your hands. These aren't just a good idea. They're what we have to do to be able to remain open.
For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
Yesterday, plans were announced for the co-development of affordable housing in Northeast Portland. The African-American nonprofit Self-Enhancement Incorporated and the Community Development Partners announced plans for 52 units of affordable housing on multiple sites along Northeast Alberta Street. In a statement, SEI President Tom Hobson Sr. said, quote, "Alberta Alive will provide quality, affordable housing opportunities for Black families and veterans, combined with wraparound services for residents," end quote. In early June, SEI and CDP jointly applied for a low-income housing tax credit from the Oregon Housing and Community Services. Once funding is approved, the plan is to build 31 units for veterans at Northeast 8th in Alberta, with an additional 21 units at Northeast Grand in Alberta for families with children. SEI and the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs will jointly provide resident services, with many being made available to the wider community. Libra Ford, Chief Operating Officer of SEI, said, quote, "We are ready to hit the ground running once funding is secured to turn these goals into actual housing that will benefit our community." The story was first reported by The Scanner. The Oregon Workers Relief Fund is beginning to distribute money to people who are undocumented and excluded from receiving aid under the CARES Act. For more on the story, here's Eric Tegedoff of the Public News Service.
Left out of the last stimulus bill from Congress, Oregonians without legal status are getting aid within the state. The Oregon Worker Relief Fund aims to distribute $1.3 million a week among people who are undocumented. Ramon Valdez is with the Innovative Law Lab, which designed the software for allocating aid.
Over the past decade, we've chosen to exclude undocumented immigrants from so many programs because of their legal status, yet we rely on them for so many different reasons, both economic and cultural and community reasons. They're a part of our community.
There are about 74,000 undocumented immigrants in Oregon, according to the Oregon Center for Public Policy. About 86,000, or 1 in 10, Oregon children live with a family member who is undocumented. More than 100 organizations came together to create the fund, including the Latino Network, ACLU of Oregon, the Farm Workers Union PICUN, and the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. Susanna Morgan heads Oregon Food Bank, which also is a supporter. She says hunger is a symptom of unequal access to things like healthy food, employment, and housing.
What this pandemic and associated economic crisis has taught us is that with adequate public investment, we can dramatically reduce hunger in Oregon as long as all families are included. And that is why the Oregon Worker Relief Fund is critical.
The program is collecting donations from Oregonians and philanthropy groups and has received $20 million from the Oregon legislature. But the groups behind the fund estimate it needs more than $120 million to help every undocumented person in the state. Adriana Miranda with the immigrant rights group CAUSA says they'll continue raising money.
It's a great investment, and we applaud the Oregon legislature for their leadership, but we know it's not sufficient to meet the full need of these Oregon families.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Earlier today, the Oregon Supreme Court overturned a Baker County judge's ruling that Governor Kate Brown's stay-home orders were unconstitutional and null and void, meaning the shelter-in-place order remains in effect in the state. Judge Matthew Shurtcliffe's injunction was brought forth following a lawsuit against Brown by a group of churches, alleging violations to the Oregon Constitution by not involving the legislature into her extended pandemic closure plans. The lawsuit also cited violations in the right of assembly and in freedom of religion. Shurtcliffe's May 18th decision was met with an immediate appeal from the governor's office, which was granted a temporary stay by the state's high court that evening. The court found that the county judge's ruling was incorrect in determining a time limit on declarations of states of emergency. It also noted the importance of public safety at this unprecedented time and vacated Shurtcliffe's order. Today's ruling ends weeks of friction between the state and conservative lawyers Ray Hack and Kevin Mannix. In a statement, Mannix said, quote, "I am disappointed, of course, in the decision, but I am not completely surprised, realizing the environment concerning the pandemic," end quote. Mannix went on to say, quote, "We will ask the legislature to amend the law to make it clear that the governor's lockdown powers truly do have a 28-day limit. At this time, there is no indication that the legislature is prepared to make any such amendment." Harry Glickman, the founder of the Portland Trailblazers, died on Wednesday at the age of 96. Glickman was responsible for bringing together the Blazers' original management group, organizing a $3.7 million expansion fee, and securing an NBA franchise for Portland in 1970. Highlights of Glickman's long and storied tenure with the team include 1977's Blazers' win of the NBA championship, along with 1990 and 1992's Western Conference championship wins. He oversaw a record 814 consecutive home sellouts during his time with the team, helping establish a benchmark for small market success in the NBA. Serving as a general manager until 1987, Glickman transitioned into the role of president emeritus and eventually retired from the Trailblazers in 1994. Neil O'Shea, the president of basketball operations, said of Glickman that, quote, he set the stage for the 1977 NBA championships, elevating Portland and allowing it to join the elite of professional sports franchises, further complementing his contributions to the city and the team. Glickman was born and raised in Portland and served in the Army in Europe during World War II, where he was awarded the Bronze Star. Glickman is survived by his wife, Joanne, son, Marshall, and daughters, Jennifer and Lynn, as well as his grandchildren, Joel, Laz, and Sydney. On the team's website, Hall of Famer Bill Walton wrote, quote, we are so lucky to be a part of your glorious and all-encompassing spirit and your life, which has given us ours. With NBA schedules suspended due to COVID-19, the Blazers plan to honor Glickman at a later date. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast. At 5:30, it's Counterspin. At 6 o'clock, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with occasional showers. The lows will be in the high 50s. Tomorrow we can expect a rainy day with the possibility of afternoon thunderstorms and a high of about 59. On this day in history, Black civil rights leader Medgar Evers was assassinated by gunmen outside his home in Jackson, Mississippi. The quote of the day is from Medgar Evers, who said, quote, when you hate, the only person that suffers is you, because most of the people you hate don't know it, and the rest don't care. Although, for the most part peaceful, many of the recent protests around the country have seen outbreaks of looting. In a knee-jerk response, many dismissed the looters as nothing more than a criminal element taking advantage of the situation. But according to this author and activist, that misses the historical perspective.
Kimberly Jones is an activist, the co-author of I'm Not Dying With You Tonight, and the host of the Atlanta chapter of the Well-Read Black Girl Book Club. She was also the powerful final voice on John Oliver's show last Sunday, where he did a searing report on the history of police violence and white supremacy. Her words become even more powerful when the historical perspective that she provided is included.
When you have a civil unrest like this, there are three types of people in the streets. There are the protesters, there are the rioters, and there are the looters. The protesters are there because they actually care about what is happening in the community. They want to raise their voices, and they are there strictly to protest. You have the rioters who are angry, who are anarchists, who really just want to up, and that's what they're going to do regardless. And then you have the looters. And the looters almost exclusively are just there to do that, to loot. Now, people are like, well, what did you gain? Well, what did you get from looting? I think that as long as we're focusing on the what, we're not focusing on the why. And some people are like, well, those aren't people who are legitimately angry about what's happening. Those are people who just want to get stuff. Okay, well then, let's go with that. Let's say that's what it is. Let's ask ourselves why in this country in 2020, the financial gap between poor blacks and the rest of the world is at such a distance that people feel like their only hope and only opportunity to get some of the things that we flaunt and flash in front of them all the time is to walk through a broken glass window and get it. We need to be questioning that why. Why are people that poor? Why are people that broke? Why are people that food insecure, that clothing insecure, that they feel like their only shot, that they are shooting their shot by walking through a broken glass window to get what they need? Let me explain to you something about economics in America. We must never forget that economics was the reason that black people were brought to this country. We came to do the agricultural work in the South and the textile work in the North. If I right now decided that I wanted to play Monopoly with you, So if I played 400 rounds of Monopoly with you and I had to play and give you every dime that I made, and then for 50 years, every time that I played, if you didn't like what I did, you got to burn it like they did in Tulsa and like they did in Rosewood, how can you win? How can you win? You can't win. The game is fixed. So when they say, why do you burn down the community? Why do you burn down your own neighborhood? It's not ours. We don't own anything. We don't own anything. Trevor Noah said it so beautifully last night. There's a social contract that we all have, that if you steal or if I steal, then the person who is the authority comes in and they fix the situation. But the person who fixes the situation is killing us. So the social contract is broken. And if the social contract is broken, why the do I give a about burning the Football Hall of Fame, about burning a Target? You broke the contract when you killed us in the streets and didn't give a. You broke the contract when for 400 years we played your game and built your wealth. You broke the contract when we built our wealth again on our own by our bootstraps in Tulsa and you dropped bombs on us. When we built it in Rosewood and you came in and you slaughtered us. You broke the contract, so your Target, your Hall of Fame. As far as I'm concerned, they could burn this bitch to the ground and it still wouldn't be enough. And they are lucky that what black people are looking for is equality and not revenge.
Both John Oliver's show and Kimberly Jones' full 6-minute clip are available on YouTube. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
Robert Fuller, a 23-year-old black man, was found hanging from a tree near City Hall in Palmdale, California at around 4 a.m. Wednesday morning. In a preliminary statement, the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department stated they believe his death was a suicide but are awaiting autopsy results. In a statement released by the department, it said, quote, "Sadly, it is not the first such incident since the COVID-19 pandemic began. People are calling on the Sheriff's Department to investigate this as a possible murder, especially in light of the recent Black Lives Matter movement and the sheriff's hasty decision to connect the death to mental health issues and COVID-19. The hashtag Justice for Robert Fuller has started trending on Twitter, and a change.org petition is calling for a full, thorough investigation that includes security footage and audio of the 911 call. KBOO will continue to monitor this story as it develops. The Louisville City Council voted unanimously on Thursday to ban no-knock warrants. The legislation is titled Breonna's Law, in honor of 26-year-old Breonna Taylor, who was killed in her home during a police raid in March. Taylor's name has been chanted across the country in protest against police brutality. Taylor, an emergency medical technician, was shot at least 8 times by officers who used a no-knock warrant to enter her apartment during a late-night drug investigation. The new Louisville measure will require police officers to knock on an entry door and announce themselves as having a search warrant. Officers will have to wait at least 15 seconds or a reasonable amount of time for occupants to answer the door before entering. The law will also require police officers to have their body cameras on when conducting a search and leave the camera on for 5 minutes before and after the operation. Officers were not wearing cameras during the March shooting that killed Breonna Taylor. In a news conference Thursday night, Taylor's family welcomed the measure. Taylor's mother, Tamika Palmer, said, quote, "All she wanted to do was save lives. With this law, she'll get to continue to do that," unquote. Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky also introduced federal legislation on Thursday to ban no-knock warrants after talking to Taylor's family. If passed, this law, titled the Justice for Breonna Taylor Act, would ban federal law enforcement agencies in nearly every jurisdiction in the country from using no-knock warrants. Thousands of soon-to-be citizens are only waiting to be sworn in so they can register to vote. And President Trump visits Texas for a high-value fundraiser. With more on those stories, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
Denying these people's rights of final, like, American citizenship has now become another form of voter suppression.
Christian Arana from the Latino Community Foundation says many hundreds of thousands of citizens-to-be are in limbo, their ability to register to vote delayed for months as they wait to complete their oath ceremonies. Two would-be U.S. citizens filed a lawsuit this week to ensure theirs will happen in time for the election. Following a COVID-19 shutdown, the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service, or USCIS, recently resumed smaller, scaled-back ceremonies. But applicants pay a significant amount of their budget. Without a bailout from Congress to close the gap, the agency will furlough two-thirds of their workers. Notices are expected next week. Diego Iniguez Lopez is with the National Partnership for New Americans, a coalition of immigration advocacy groups.
Our concern is that that is an intentional effort by the Trump administration to make it more difficult for immigrants and refugees to naturalize and use that as a means of gaining economic benefits as well as further civically engaging themselves, like, for example, being able to vote in 2020 in other elections.
But 3 million citizens have been naturalized since 2016 and are eligible to vote this year. Arana says that could have a big impact in battleground states, Florida, Pennsylvania, and even Texas, where President Trump held an in-person fundraiser yesterday.
The civic engagement already started with wanting to become an American citizen. And there's this already this just general interest in wanting to contribute to your community. And while not all of us can have a lot of money to our name, you know, we can make a difference by voting, right?
The president also met with pastors, law enforcement officials, and small business owners in Dallas to discuss race and policing. He did not invite the county's 3 top law enforcement officials, the Dallas police chief, sheriff, and district attorney, who are all Black. Trump also took time to tweet his opposition to renaming military bases and other government assets that honor Confederate figures. Some Capitol Hill Republicans broke with the president to support the measure. In 2016, just 8% of Black voters went for Trump. Aaron Cullen, who writes for conservative outlet The Blaze, thinks it's because many Republican leaders don't acknowledge that racism is still an issue.
It's very divisive, and you've seen very different responses from different sides of the aisle. I come from it from the conservative point of view and from a Black conservative point of view, which is, you know, kind of interesting when you're dealing with race issues, the way that conservatives tend to respond to these types of things.
Cullen says this moment could be an opportunity for the GOP to connect with Black voters.
Black voters do care about these things, and they do feel in a lot of cases that police departments and police officers are not treating them equitably in the way that force is being used. And in some of these communities, that is the case. And so if you're going to deny that, it's sort of a non-starter for a lot of Black voters to say, well, if you can't even see where I'm coming from on that, then why should I trust you with my vote?
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
The Native American Rights Fund is looking to ensure voting rights. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Native American Rights Fund has outlined ways to avoid potential voting barriers for Native Americans as states prep for the 2020 election and consider safety options amid the COVID-19 pandemic, Christine Trudeau reports.
Any move to an entirely vote-by-mail system for the 2020 elections would be a big problem for voters in Indian country, with the potential to disenfranchise many. That's according to Jacqueline DeLeon, a staff attorney with the Native American Rights Fund and a co-author of NARF's recent voting rights report detailing multiple voting barriers that Native Americans face today. DeLeon says inconsistent mail service in Indian country is why vote by mail alone isn't a good option.
The way mail works in Indian country is if you're getting mail at all, it's likely going to be at a post office through a post office box that you might be sharing with, you know, 15 other people. I mean, that was not unheard of to hear just a lot of people sharing one post office box.
Anne says DeLeon, in the process of picking up and distributing that mail from a shared P.O. box, it's not uncommon for items to get misplaced or delivered to the wrong person, making the wait to get mail delivered longer, sometimes taking up to a month. In light of this and other challenges facing voters on access and safety, NARF has put out a guide advocating specific changes that could help many Native voters across Indian country, like maintaining in-person voting.
An in-person voting option can be controlled. You can have, you know, PPE, sanitation practices. You can do curbside voting. You can utilize Native community members and say that, you know, they're the ones that are running the polls to, like, you know, reduce the introduction of outside people. And that kind of controlled environment is better than sort of this, you know, hodgepodge way that people get mail in Indian country now.
NARF's other recommendations include increasing the number of ballot collection boxes available through Election Day, that tribes be able to designate buildings to pick up and drop off ballots, that early voting hours for elderly and the immunocompromised are available and creating a robust educational outreach campaign to tribal communities on any updates to the voting process. You can find out more about these recommendations at narf.org/vote-by-mail. I'm Christine Trudeau.
This story is a collaboration with National Native News and the Solutions Journalism Network. A crowd of people watched as a statue of Christopher Columbus was taken down with a rope Wednesday in St. Paul by some members of the Native community. In a live stream by television station KSTP, people cheered as the statue hit the ground. A hand drum song and round dance followed as law enforcement watched nearby, then cleared the area holding batons, waiting for its removal. The move at Minnesota's Capitol follows the beheading of a Columbus statue in Boston and Confederate statues in different parts of the country torn down after the recent police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Floyd's death has sparked protests across the country over police violence against people of color and reignited the debate over controversial monuments. Columbus is a symbol of genocide to Native Americans, as people see taking down memorials in his honor and dropping the Columbus Day holiday as part of the healing process. Sea Alaska Heritage Institute kicked off Celebration 2020 virtually Wednesday. The large in-person gathering in Southeast Alaska is postponed this year due to COVID-19. The four-day broadcast on YouTube and public television features dance, art, storytelling, and other events. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 12, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Hannah Merzbach, Nat Moon, Jeffrey Wade, and Ray Bodwell. The producer is Ray Bodwell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez and Lily Bolke. The director of Evening